Welcome to the story of the century, and to this recounting of it, done with the voices of its most important people, each telling their part. Enjoy the listening, and you will understand why we call it Keeping Hope Alive. A couple of points that need to be remembered. First, though the herbal tea was continually changed throughout Reen Case's decades of research by herself, and then when she was in partnership with Dr. Charles Bruch, Reen still had to name it. So, at that time, she just spelled her last name backwards, and the generic name of Essiac was formed. It was not until the newspaper article on this tea was published in 1992 that it became important to make a definite distinction between the formula with the four main herbs in it and the full eight-herb formula called fluorescence. Second, none of the information on this tape is to be misconstrued in any way as a diagnosis or prescription. If you have a health concern, please consult your health practitioner. And now I would like to introduce Lida Fair. She was Elaine Alexander's secretary and is now the official spokesperson for fluorescence from Elaine Alexander's office. Mrs. Fair will narrate the story and bring in the voices of the main personalities in this fascinating tale.
Hello, my name is Lida Fair, and I would like to introduce you to a story that began over 100 years ago. Most of the telling will be done by the voices of the people most closely involved in this tale. Reen Case, the nurse from Bracebridge, Ontario, who was given the original list of herbs. Dr. Charles Bruch of Cambridge, Massachusetts, a very well-respected physician, and Reen's partner for 20 years. And finally, Elaine Alexander of Vancouver, British Columbia, the broadcaster who brought this story to the public during the 1980s and the 1990s. Their voices will be brought in from interviews that have been taped over the years to give you the details. This story had its beginnings almost exactly 100 years before the herbal tea called fluorescence was made available to the general public as the eight-herb formula that Reen Case and Dr. Bruch perfected during their 20-year partnership. In 1892, in northern Ontario, a medicine man of the Ojibwe tribe from the Algonquin Nation of North American Indians healed a white woman who was suffering from a serious growth in her breast. He did this using a tea the healers of his people had developed from the native wild plants. He also generously gave her the names of the plants and showed her what they looked like and where they grew in the woods and fields around them. Reen Case, our first personality, enters the story in 1922. At that time, Reen was the head nurse at a hospital in a little town called Haileybury in northern Ontario. She was born into a large, happy, caring, and loving family. It was her childhood that gave Reen her code of ethics and her love of her fellow human beings. She was once quoted as saying that the love and respect of her fellow man meant much more to her and to her family than any riches. Reen is going to relate a little about herself and her early history.
What's your name, ma'am?
Reen Case.
Were you born here in Bracebridge?
Yes. I was one of a family of 11. I was the middle of the family. There were some three boys. And, I can't tell you all my family life and my...
Why did you become a nurse?
Oh, in 1912, I think.
Why?
Well, I wanted to be a nurse. My people couldn't afford to put me through for a doctor, that I really would like to have been a doctor.
Reen had many facets to her personality. She was very patient and had quite a stubborn streak. Both of these stood her in excellent stead during her decades-long fight to have her simple herbal remedy accepted by the various authorities, governmental and medical. She had a very sharp mind, a big, somewhat puckish sense of humor, and a heart that wanted to help the world. One evening in 1922, when Reen was on her rounds at the hospital, she met an elderly Englishwoman. Reen is going to tell us now what happened that fateful evening.
My nurse, one of the nurses, was bathing this patient, and I happened to walk in, and I noticed that the breast was a nodular mass of scar tissue, and I asked about it. So she told me all the story about how she had come from England to prospect with her husband up in northern Ontario, and that she developed this growth in her breast, and the Indians offered to tell her how to cure it, you know, with the herbs. And her husband wouldn't listen to that. He took her down to Toronto to make sure what it was. So they came down, and they did a biopsy, I guess, and they advised her to have it operated, to have her breast removed. And she had seen a friend of hers have that operation and die. And she didn't want an operation. So she said they went back, and the Indians told her about these herbs. And she said she made tea with it, and they eventually showed her how to get them herself. And she took them for, she said, over a year before it was entirely gone, and she had, it was 30 years and she hadn't had a recurrence. So that's what interested me, because I knew that at that time, after operation, they invariably had a recurrence, you see, because there was nothing to stop it. They hadn't any x-ray or radium or any of the things they have today. So anyway, I asked her if she mind telling me what the herbs were, and she did. She was willing to do it, so I wrote them down. So anyway, I didn't think I'd ever have any use for it, you know. But about a year and a half after, it was that I got word that my dearest aunt, my mother's only sister, had been operated on in Brockville by the Beaumonts.
The doctors that did the operation were specialists, and they discovered that her aunt had a large growth in her stomach and that her liver was involved. They gave Reen's aunt at most 6 months to live.
So I asked Dr. R.O. Fisher, her doctor, if I could use the herbs, and he said, certainly, he said, there's nothing we can do. So I said, will you keep track of how she's getting along? Because I said, I don't know anything about these herbs, but I'm just going to try them. He watched me treat her, and he saw the results, saw her get better. And as she got better, he got asking me to treat other patients, terminal cases. And Dr. Hoyge on Bloor Street, he asked if he could send me patients. So
what did that treatment consist of at that time? That was your first treatment.
I just gave it as an oral treatment. I made it up.
What, you gathered the herbs and
yes,
sort of steeped them in hot water like you'd make tea?
Boiled them, yes, just as you'd make tea. And they weren't bad to take.
And your aunt drank this stuff?
Yes.
Was it one treatment or
no,
for a period?
No, I gave it to her every day. Oh, I gave it to her for a year or more, but she never had any more trouble.
How long was she taking it when it became apparent that it was doing some good?
Oh, about 2 months. We noticed a difference, that she was eating and she was digesting her food, which she hadn't been doing before. And, you could feel the mass in the liver, because it was a nodular mass, you see. But you could see, you could feel that getting softer and smaller. But old Dr. Fisher examined her over and over and over again while I was treating, you know, to make sure.
Dr. Fisher asked Reen to treat other patients, and soon other doctors were referring their hopeless cases to Reen as well. Over the next few years, Reen and Dr. Fisher experimented with the herbs.
We tried by elimination on mice, got down to where I could give it hypodermically. Well, then the growth would reduce in size, but the patient wouldn't get better. The general condition of the patient wouldn't get better. So Dr. Fisher said, well, why not give the hypodermic injection and give a dose of the medicine with it at the same time? So I used to give an ounce of the medicine orally and give the hypodermic injection.
Reen was only given a list of 8 herbs, and she had to gather them herself.
Where would you gather the herbs? Are they just common herbs that grow all over the place?
Some of them are. Some of them I had to get from the wholesalers. First, it was 8 different kinds, and there were so few of them here. I could use some that were here, and then I had to get them from the wholesales. When I had too many patients, I had to get more material to work with. And you see, in those days, there was no spraying, there was no radioactive fallout, there was nothing like that. You could pick things up in my father owned a case island down here in the Muskoka Lakes, and I'd go down there and get what I could there.
But you could trust any herb that you'd pick,
oh,
then.
Yes.
You'd know it would be pure.
Oh, yes, definitely. And there was no content with any kind of spray or anything like that. It was a different world I lived in.
From the time she started treating people in the 1920s, on through the years her clinic was open from 1934 to 1942, Reen did not charge for the treatments. She would work during the day as a nurse, treat people with the brew in the evening, and make up the next day's batch at night. Then her mother moved back to Bracebridge, and Reen moved into an apartment. Reen wound up treating at least 30 people every day, who had been sent to her by several doctors. Gradually, this pace got to be too much for her, and she had to give up nursing. Her neighbors in the apartment building objected to all the traffic, and so she moved into a house in Peterborough and settled there for a while. Reen's herbal treatment was getting very well known by then, and no sooner had she settled into the house in Peterborough than a gentleman came to the door.
I think he was a doctor, I don't know for sure. And he said, are you Miss Case? And I said, yes. He said, I have come to issue a warrant for your arrest for malpractice. I said, well, I am surprised about that, because I said, I have letters from the Honorable Dr. Robb, who was Minister of Health at that time, and the different doctors. I had letters authorizing me to treat the patients, you see. And I wasn't even dressed. I was in my dressing gown. And I excused myself and went upstairs and got dressed. And he read these letters in the meantime, and he said, Miss Case, I'm not going to issue this warrant for your arrest. He said, I'm going back and talk to my chief, Dr. Noble. He was head of the College of Physicians and Surgeons. So I never did hear from him again.
This was Reen's first real run-in with the medical authorities. Reen wrote to Dr. Robb and to Dr. Fisher to see if something could be done to enable her to treat people and stay within the law. Other challenges to her expertise were not long in coming. A petition sent to the Department of Health and Welfare was signed by 8 doctors, requesting permission for Reen to be allowed to continue to treat people.
These 9 doctors, or 8 of them, I think, were there, and they signed a petition to Ottawa to ask that I be given the facilities to do deeper research and to spend my time doing it, you know, not just trying to nurse and do this work at night. So anyway, they sent 2 doctors to arrest me, Dr. Harland and Dr. Woodrow. When they saw what I was doing, what I had done, and what I was doing, they wouldn't issue a warrant. They were like the man that came to Peterborough.
In fact, one of the doctors who brought the warrant became so interested in her work that he arranged for Reen to be able to do more research at the Christie Street Hospital. In 1934, a doctor from Bracebridge, Dr. Bastido, sent her a patient with a serious growth in his bowels. The man stayed with Reen for 3 months, and over that time, the growth disappeared.
So Dr. Bastido was really impressed. He called me up and he said, "Doreen," he said, I went before the council and the mayor, and he said, "They will give you the old British Lion Hotel as a clinic if you'll come back to your hometown and prove your work." So I went back to Bracebridge, and we got this hotel across from the jail, handy for me, and the town helped me, and town people, my friends and relatives and everybody helped me. The men come over and they separated the downstairs into a lobby and treatment rooms and an office and a dispensary. The patients that came followed me, gave me pictures and things to hang on the wall, and curtains and drapes and so on for the living room, and set me up real good, and the town people were wonderful to me, just wonderful.
However, Reen was still concerned about the authorities. She would joke about it, but the fear was still on her mind.
Well, you were in pretty dicey ground then. You were probably breaking the law in a technical sense, or coming very close, eh?
Oh, close enough, I guess. The jailer used to say he was saving a room for me across the road. So I was always just one step ahead of the law, I guess.
Did a lot of people come to that clinic in the old hotel then?
Oh, they started to come. That's where I was treating so many patients. I treated 300 to 600 patients there. Eventually, you know, not right away, of course. But I got known from one end of the continent to the other. And I'd get letters from patients from Europe and South America and Mexico and all over the place.
How long did you keep that clinic going in Bracebridge?
8.5 years.
How many people do you think went through it in that time?
Oh, I don't know. I couldn't tell you. Thousands, I guess.
Just after her clinic opened, Reen's mother, at the age of 72, was diagnosed with a growth in her liver. She had a weak heart and therefore could not undergo surgery. Reen just quietly gave her mother the injection and the oral amount of the tea. She just said it was a tonic the doctor had ordered. Her mother recovered and lived another 18 years before she died of heart disease. During her years at her clinic, Reen was approached by Northwestern University in Chicago. A group of doctors there wanted her to come and work on 30 different patients whom they had hand-picked. The diagnoses were all different, and all of the patients were terminal. Reen worked with them, and the results were good enough that she was offered her own clinic if she would come down to Chicago's Passavant Hospital. The five doctors who were monitoring the cases came to the conclusion that Reen's treatment prolonged life, relieved pain, and broke down the mass of the growths. Reen looked at the proposal and in the end turned them down. She could not do it.
But I'd have to leave all my patients in Bracebridge, and I knew they were as poor as Joe Serkey and that they couldn't come to Chicago and get treatments, and I wasn't going to let them die in the meantime, you see. That's another offer I refused.
She was still dealing with many skeptical doctors that came to her from all over North America. One of them was a very prestigious doctor from New York.
Dr. Leonardo came from Rochester. He was the mayor of Rochester, and he came with the governor of New York. They were touristing up in Muskoka, you see, and they heard about me, and he came, and he introduced himself, and he said he was a specialist. He was a surgeon. He said, "You think you have a cure?" I said, "I'm way beyond thinking, I know." He said, "I don't believe it." He said, "Would you mind if I talk to the patients?" And I said, "Not at all." I guess there was about 50 patients sitting around, and he talked to them. Well, he came the 4 days and talked to patients. And the next time he came, he said, "Well," he said, you're doing them good, but," he said, "it isn't your treatment." He said, "It's you." He said, "You're giving them hope." And he said, I don't believe your treatment's doing anything." So anyway, I had six doctors in the dispensary examining patients, and they had been coming each time and following the cases up, you see, to see if there was improvement or not. And Dr. Leonardo asked me if he could go in with the other doctors, so I said yes. And he came several times, and he examined patients. He was a big, bluff fellow. He sat down, and he said, "You've got it." But he said, "The medical profession isn't going to let you do this to me." He said, I went through college 7 years, and he said, "Every year I've been going to Vienna for 2 months special surgery, and I've written 3 books, and," he said, "I could go home and burn them." He said, "It would revolutionize the whole treatment. They'll never let you do it."
Reen did not believe him. She was ever hopeful that one day the medical people would see and understand that what she was doing was valid and helpful.
I always hoped that I would eventually convince them that I had something and that they would accept it and make it available where I couldn't. They could have made it available to thousands of people that I couldn't reach at all, you see. And I was so anxious for that, that nothing else mattered to me. I just wanted to get it available to people who needed it anywhere in the world. And I wanted to make it a Canadian discovery. I was proud enough to want to do that.
By 1938, Reen Case's support was immense. Another petition was circulated, and this time 55,000 signatures were on it. People from every walk of life, including doctors and other professionals, gave their support to Reen in her fight to have the herbal tea accepted and to let her at least continue to help people. In March of 1938, Frank Kelly, a member of the legislature, introduced a private member's bill to the Ontario government. This bill proposed that Reen Case be officially authorized to treat this devastating illness in all its forms. Reen herself was mostly interested in permission to treat people before they were diagnosed as terminal. She wanted to try to help people before they had gone through the trauma of the orthodox therapies. At the same time that the supportive bill was introduced, a new health minister, the Honorable Harold Kirby, introduced another bill to the legislature, the Kirby Bill, as it was called. This bill proposed that it would protect the public by establishing a commission to look at controversial treatments to see if they had any merit. If this bill passed, a commission would be established with the rights to investigate all alternative treatment methods, and only if the supporting evidence was conclusive would the remedy be authorized. Kelly's bill went to debate first. 3 members of Parliament vigorously defended the bill, and several patients were allowed to tell of their miraculous recoveries. Finally, Reen Case was permitted to speak. It is reported that the legislature was silent as she spoke, and the following is a quote of one of the things she said. "The fact that I can get any results at all should be accepted as a good thing. When I had success, I thought the doctors would welcome me with open arms. I didn't anticipate antagonism from the profession. I expected cooperation, and I have every respect for the profession." End quote. Things were now at an impasse. Reen would not submit her formula because she believed it would be immediately shelved as worthless. She also wanted to ensure that the people who needed it could still get it.
I said, "If you will guarantee that it will be used, that it will be made available to suffering humanity, there isn't a price tag on it, it's yours."
The doctors at the hearing took the stance that her refusal to disclose the formula was prime evidence that her tea had no real merit, and that it would be exposed as a hoax. Reen tells us how the doctors responded.
We can't give you that assurance. We'll have to test it, and we'll tell you whether it has merit or not. After seeing all those patients and everything else, they still wouldn't admit that it was a cure.
After she spoke, a vote was called for and taken. Frank Kelly's bill was defeated by 3 votes. If it had passed, the medical authorities would have had to accept Reen's tea as a treatment. This would have been tantamount to endorsing her herbal tea, and that was unacceptable. A few days later, the bill from those opposing Reen, the Kirby bill, was quietly passed and made into law, and the commission was established. In December of 1939, after lengthy debates, the commission made its report. The essence of it was that there was no merit in Reen's remedy, and that if she continued to treat people without disclosing the formula, she would be charged with practicing medicine without a license. Reen was disheartened. She closed her clinic in 1942 and moved to North Bay with her husband. It was only after his death that she returned to Bracebridge. In 1958, the next part of the story unfolds. This is when Dr. Charles Armeo Bruch of Cambridge, Massachusetts, is made aware of Reen and her herbal remedy. Dr. Bruch was a very well-respected and well-known medical doctor. He had degrees in surgery, internal medicine, obstetrics, and psychiatry. He was the co-founder of the first medical center in Cambridge, one of the largest clinics in the state. A many-faceted, very open-minded professional, he had interests in many fields, including herbal medicine. Dr. Bruch received several prestigious awards for his contributions, achievements, and service in the field of medicine. Dr. Bruch practiced medicine for 54 years, and during those years, many thousands of people went to him for help. Although Elaine Alexander herself does not enter this story until later on, she is probably the best person to tell you how he got involved with Reen Case. So let's hear what she has to say about that pivotal occasion.
It came about by a man traveling to New York City, and he went to see a publisher, and the publisher's name was Ralph Daig. He was the publisher of the biggest men's magazine called True. With him, he took a suitcase full of background material on Reen Case and what she'd done. He put the suitcase down on the publisher's desk, and he simply said, "You're in the publishing business. You should read this, and you should do something about it." And then he left. So the publisher and a friend of his, who was a scientist, started going through this information that was in the suitcase, and they couldn't believe what they were reading. So they made a little trip to Bracebridge. They looked up Reen. They interviewed her. They found some doctors that had known Reen. They found that it was not a fraud. And so they went back to New York, and they thought, what on earth can we do with this? How can we ever get this out? One of them heard of Dr. Charles A. Bruch with the Bruch Medical Clinic, because he had one of the biggest clinics in the state of Massachusetts. And President John Kennedy had laid the cornerstone of that clinic for Dr. Bruch. Dr. Bruch, he was the private physician of John Kennedy, and had been a longtime friend of President Kennedy. And he made a call to Dr. Bruch, and Dr. Bruch listened to what he had to say. And he said, "Well, you know, I have a hobby of herbs. Indeed, I do know about herbs." So that was enough for Ralph Daig. He got Reen and Dr. Bruch together. Dr. Bruch brought Reen Case down to the clinic in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he gave her 3 rooms in the clinic and the use of a laboratory, and he set her up in a hotel. He picked up all her costs because she had no money at all.
One of the first things Reen and Dr. Bruch did during the early years of their partnership was to eliminate the injection of one of the herbs.
It began from the Ojibwe with 8 herbs, and Reen and her aunt doctor began to change it. That was in 1924. Then they used it partly injected and partly oral. But when in 1959 she went to Dr. Bruch did not like the injectable. So painful and emaciated patients, it was excruciating. Dr. Bruch had a wider view of it. He wanted to get it to a point where it would help far more than just a malignancy. It only started to have the synergistic activity that he and his doctors there were looking for when it got back to 8 ingredients again.
Elaine will elaborate a little on why and how Reen and Dr. Bruce worked on the formula.
Dr. Bruce had never worked with the formula, so he did what Reen did and Dr. Fisher years before. He tore it all apart, wanted to see what made it tick, and until he saw the synergistic activity that he knew they should be getting, and in Dr. Bruce's mind, he wanted it for use, too, for many other problems. He felt that if it went back to a bigger formula the way it had been from the Indians, that possibly they could get more synergistic activity, which he found they could.
So they brought the formula back, as close as they could, to the original 8 herbs for which Reen had been given the names in 1922. Herbal remedies have a long and well-documented history. References to herbal medications go back more than 5,000 years in books such as the Bible and in archaeological evidence from China, India, and Egypt, and many other countries around the Mediterranean Sea. If such remedial herbs did not work, they would not have been mentioned in the many written records available to us. In societies such as those of the North American Indians, where healing traditions are passed on orally, if a herbal remedy had not worked, the information would not have been transmitted verbally to the next generation of medicine men and women. Dr. Bruce was a firm believer in herbal remedies, and he came to believe the same way in the remedy he and Reen were developing. Let's hear what Dr. Bruce had to say about this.
It worked because, for the first thing, if you want to look back to the Bible, herbs were the things that cure man. And if you notice all through the history of centuries, digitalis and any of these other drugs, morphine and herbs of all nature are the things that all of modern medicine has been built on. I feel that in the herbs, you've got the amino acids, you've got the enzymes and all, and at this day particularly, when there's so much contamination and so much pollution and these other diseases we're dealing with, this herb will help an individual to replace his damage and to improve his condition. And here you've got an herb, several herbs, non-toxic, very inexpensive, you can take with any condition you have, and it improves what other condition you have. When we did the research here with us, what we were trying to find out, was there any other active ingredient in these herbs, just a single one? You go back to Rini's herb business with the injection. That's what she used to use, and we did use. But we found in our research work that if we used all of the ingredients instead of one ingredient in the injection, it would work much quicker, and it had more vitality, it would work better.
Reen Case and Dr. Bruce were legal partners from 1958 until her death in 1978, even though Reen was not at the clinic for all those years. She went back to Bracebridge after they found out that the doctors were being warned not to send patients to Dr. Bruce's clinic. In fact, the American Medical Association made it clear to Reen Case and to Dr. Bruce that its members were no longer permitted to send patients to clinics that used unknown remedies. When the labs, which had supplied the mice injected with human cells, sent letters saying they would no longer be able to process material from the clinic, Reen knew that pressure had been put on them as well. So rather than battle it out again, Reen went home. However, she had formed a deep friendship with Dr. Bruce, and this strengthened their partnership. 1977 was the last time Reen Case's name and her formula were brought into prominence during her life. This was the year that Homemaker magazine wrote an in-depth article about her and the work she had done over the decades. A retired chemist, after he read the story, approached Reen several times in the ensuing months. He was trying to persuade her to sign over the formula to his company. Elaine Alexander explains some of the details.
This man that had suddenly entered her life told her that his small company would be well back if he was given the formula, and that finally Reen's dream of acceptance for her treatment would be realized. For he had medical people on his board and knew powerful people in high places, and they could move mountains.
In the contract, it was agreed that not only would 5 clinics be set up across Canada to test the formula, but that many individual doctors were to test the tea on their patients as well. Whether past experiences had made Reen extremely wary and sensitive or not, Reen made a judgment call and passed on a formula containing only the four main herbs to the retired chemist. Respirin, the company that got the four-herb formula, tried to fulfill their promise. But just as Reen herself had been stymied, they found themselves in a deadlock with the commission that had been set up by the government. The company wouldn't release what they had, and the commission would not approve the formula without complete disclosure. The year before Reen died, in 1978, during one of the last interviews done with Reen, the interviewer asked her whether she felt she had done the right thing.
Oh, I'm sure I have. I've helped an awful lot of people.
Thousands.
By myself, I did. I treated and treated. I'd be up half the night and all night some nights making ampules and making medicine and what have you. And work from 9 o'clock in the morning till 9 o'clock at night. I wasn't lazy. Not a bit. And when I saw the appreciation in the eyes of the patients that were no longer in pain and had to take sedatives for so long to keep out of pain, and to find that they could go without these and just live a normal life, it repaid me over and over again.
The ultimate vote of confidence that could be given to the herbal tea was given by Dr. Bruch in a letter he wrote in 1990. In this letter, he states that he used the tea from his first diagnosis with a colorectal growth in 1984 until the writing of the letter in 1990. Elaine Alexander enters the story herself in 1984. Elaine was a broadcaster with the abilities of a trained vocal performer and the determination of a crusader. In the mid-1970s, she had been the producer of a radio show in Canada called The Hotline, and she is going to start by telling us what that show was all about.
The Hotline that I produced for so long truly pioneered talk radio in Canada. We were known for the world newsmakers and the controversial issues and interviews that we aired. Anything under the sun was the way we put it, and we meant it. We introduced the kind of radio that informed listeners, and it was common for us to have as guests on our show everyone from the likes of Baroness Maria von Trapp of Sound of Music fame, to Martin Luther King, and then to Bernadette Devlin, the firebrand of Ireland, debating with the Reverend Ian Paisley in Belfast. And we had Arnold Schwarzenegger, larger than life, before he became a multimillionaire. And he filled up half the studio, world figures of the day. And for the first time, listeners could participate, ask questions, and have a dialogue with these newsmakers. Never been done before. And we dared to pioneer introducing to the primetime airwaves names in the alternative health field and others, such as Dr. Wilfred Shute, Dr. Ernesto Contreras and his Laetril, Linus Pauling, Adele Davis, again too many to record here. We gave wide exposure to all these issues to inform and make people think.
One of the many fields this show covered was the area of alternative health care. In 1984, when Elaine began broadcasting herself, she did so because she wanted to really investigate this field and bring her findings to the public in the same format of an open-line talk show.
When I began broadcasting myself in 1984, I then continued to examine health issues and began by painting an in-depth picture of the woman called Reen Case and her treatment, and brought on air many guests who had any part in the unfolding of this fascinating story over the decades. One of the people I contacted for an interview was Dr. Charles Bruch, M.D., of Cambridge, Massachusetts. He graciously agreed, and I interviewed him a number of times, for I ended up doing 7 2-hour programs on this very story, for the listener demand was so great.
Elaine had done her homework and had researched the story very well. Since Elaine's show was an open-line program, and people were encouraged to call, from the very first interview with Dr. Bruch, the switchboard at the station was lit up like a Christmas tree. There were even people waiting to talk to Elaine outside the station when that program finished airing. Over the next 2 years, this happened after each of the 7 2-hour shows on which Elaine spoke about this incredible formula. People began to see in this herbal tea the possibility of hope, and in Elaine, the continuation of the legacy of Rene Case. Since she and Dr. Bruch were in touch so frequently, during their conversations, gradually an idea developed that was so simple it was stunning. They asked themselves, why are we trying to push against firmly established procedures in the medical field when what we have is a simple herbal tea? It's a cleanser for every system in the body, a very good and gentle detoxifier. Why not market it as just that? By now, Dr. Bruch was in his early 80s, and he didn't want to see this herbal remedy disappear. Dr. Bruch knew that Elaine understood the story deeply and completely. This deepened their friendship, and a bond of trust and respect developed between them. Because of this, he asked Elaine to become his partner. He wanted to see the idea of getting the tea to the public pursued, and he knew that Elaine would make sure the integrity of the tea would be maintained, and that she would continue the crusade to make it available to as many people as possible.
So we became friends, and in 1988 we became partners, and he passed all the formulas that they had worked together on. While he and Rene were partners, and he turned them all over to me legally, and I have world rights to what we now call Flora Essence.
The next breakthrough in this story occurred in the early 1990s. Elaine had been instrumental in the improvement of the life of an 11-year-old girl suffering from a serious growth in her brain. The Vancouver Sun, our daily paper, wanted to write up the story and spoke to the mother of the little girl.
The mother told them what she felt that the formula that I'd given her had done and what effect it had. And then she simply said, I think the one you should see is Elaine Alexander. So then I received a call from the feature writer, Mia Stainsby. And Mia said, I've been to see Michelle's mother, and she mentioned that you knew a great deal about this subject. I said, yes, what do you know about it? And she said, well, we know nothing about it, nothing. And I said, you cannot write about this subject because it's so complex unless you do some homework. Well, I give them credit. She did do homework, and she became quite fascinated with the whole story and called me again and finally said, we want to do an article on this, and it's going to be a larger article than what we thought. So she said, can we do an interview with you right now? They came and spent many hours with me, and it went on from there. After they left, it grew. The story grew. The editors began to love it. I got calls from the editors. They said, Elaine, we cannot understand how we in the media have never even heard of this. And it's a Canadian discovery. And it goes back so long. So they said, we're going to make a feature article out of this. Well, there it was. I opened the paper one day, and there was the article. So that's how the Vancouver Sun article came about in May the 16th, 92. When it hit the streets, my phone started ringing, and I was totally inundated with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of calls and people. It was impossible to handle it. Calls were coming from everywhere, from the United States, from Eastern Canada, then it grew. Then the Eastern papers picked up the story, and then the calls were coming from Europe, and you name it. Well, it was beyond me.
Fortunately, before this article was published, Elaine realized that in order to get this tea out to the people who needed it, she had to find a reputable, well-established manufacturing company in the natural health industry.
Now, prior to the Vancouver Sun coming out, I had met with Flora Manufacturing and Distributing. I had gone out to their head office, and I had had a meeting with the principals there. And they knew about what I had. We had a wonderful meeting. I told them the story. We took a liking to each other, and it was just as simple as that.
Then the newspaper article came out, and for about 5 weeks, Elaine was able to handle the load.
From the first call on, the people that were calling me had been given up as hopeless. They were at the very, very end of the road. They had done everything that their doctors had wanted them to, and it had failed. They were left in such terrible condition, and many of them were all alone. There wasn't even one person to give them a cup of tea. They were all at the end of the road. And they cried and sobbed to think that they finally contacted somebody that would listen to them, that maybe could offer them a little hope. And this went on and on for 36 days and nights. The only times the phone stopped was when I took them off the hook. And I would flop into my bed under a sea of paper. Paper was everywhere. Cars were lining the streets. People were coming up my front door, my back door. My living room was full. This was just beyond me. So I met with Flora Manufacturing and Distributing again. They, by this time, had seen the Vancouver Sun article, very impressed with it, and we sat down to serious conversation. And they agreed to help me and take this off my hands. They had the facilities. They had all the capability. They're known as a company full of integrity and only wanting quality products. So, to me, it was a blessing, an absolute blessing.
Flora was established in 1965. When Thomas Greither came to Flora, he brought with him a family history and tradition in natural health that went back three generations to 1916 and his grandfather, who established Salus House, one of Germany's foremost manufacturers and distributors of herbal products. In Flora, Elaine found a company which adheres to the highest standards and stringent quality controls and demands herbs that are pure, potent, and fresh. Flora is currently certified by the organic certifying agency called Quality Assurance International, or QAI. Flora was, therefore, perfectly positioned to take on the challenge of manufacturing and distributing this incredibly effective herbal tea.
That is how Flora and I became involved. And what happened then was that I gradually gave up what I was doing, and Flora took over. Now, what I have that Dr. Bruce has passed me is now called Florescence, is a superb formula capable of identifying toxins, gathering and flushing out of the body, and it is known to give a sense of well-being and can be safely taken by anyone. In our world, there's so much pollution or toxins, they're everywhere. And statistics show that with many diseases, we seem to be losing the battle. Florescence can be taken as a preventative and also may improve the immune system.
Flora was the first out in the marketplace with Florescence, ahead of all similar competing formulas. Today, as Florescence becomes known by word of mouth, and as the enthusiastic stories of help received are spread, told by people who benefited, more and more people are calling the office wanting information and help. Their hope for health was being rekindled and kept alive. To give you an idea of what the herbs in Florescence do, Elaine is going to tell you which ones they are and what actions each of them have on our bodies.
Well, now there's burdock root, of course. That's a powerful cleanser and purifier. And it improves the elimination of wastes and fluids that are toxic to the body. And it can relieve infections and reduce swellings, etc. And helps strengthen the vital organs. Another herb is slippery elm bark. And it's the inner bark that is used, which feeds and it soothes and it strengthens the mucous membranes of the body. It stimulates growth and repair and revitalizes the entire body. And, of course, it cleanses and heals and strengthens. Of course, sheep sorrel, which is really the main herb, it relieves inflammation. It's a cleanser and a strengthener. And, of course, it's very effective in attacking and breaking down tissue masses and other deposits, etc. And that's a very important herb. And then there's turkey rhubarb root. And it contains many vitamins we need, as well as high amounts of most necessary minerals. It acts as a general stimulant on the stomach and the associated organs. It assists in the digestive tract, etc. Then there's watercress. That was used in folk medicine many, many years ago. It's a very effective cleanser and toner and strengthener of mucous membranes. Then blessed thistle. That's an ancient herb that has an antibiotic effect. It has bitter qualities that stimulate and cleanse the digestive organs in particular, and it strengthens them and improves the appetite. Then there's red clover. For many years, it's cleansed and soothed the lungs and air passages, and it soothes the pain and suffering of problems of inflammation in the joints. Then there's kelp, the last herb, which is full of several important minerals, etc. It is very effective as a toxin scavenger in the intestinal tract, and it prevents these poisons from entering the blood. It's a marvelous and good blood cleanser.
What does fluorescence do? How does it work? Again, Elaine will give you the details.
First of all, it was non-toxic. There were no side effects. And it was safe with all medications and therapies. And it supplied a great deal of nutrition in the form of vitamins, enzymes, and minerals. These are all necessary for proper cell metabolism and regeneration. And it boosted the immune system tremendously. That's the first thing it did. It cleansed the blood and the liver. It decreased the pain tremendously, eliminated altogether from many of them so they could get off things like morphine. And it was a natural sedative which calmed the patient down. When they take it at bedtime, they get a marvelous sleep. And it reduced masses and can break them down and discharge them completely. It goes completely through the body from head to toe and has the ability to identify those cells and gather them and discharge from the body through the bowel movements and through the urine.
Well, that's the story as it stands right now. Fluorescence is incredibly helpful for those who want to give their bodies all the protection they can. And the tea continues to be extraordinarily beneficial for many people who have no other place to turn. Recent independent studies on the safety of fluorescence show that this preparation produces no toxic effects at all. From this retelling of this incredible story, I hope you gained some understanding of why we call it Keeping Hope Alive. I wish you good health, take care, and God bless.
Fluorescence is available at most health food stores in North America. If you cannot find it at a store near you, please call the following numbers. In Western Canada, area code 604-436-6000. In Eastern Canada, area code 905-791-3111. In the United States, 1-800-446-2110. If you would like to receive more information, or if you have some questions, please call area code 604-451-8232. If you prefer to write, the address is Elaine Alexander's Office, 4728 Byrne, that's spelled B-Y-R-N-E, Road, Burnaby, B-U-R-N-A-B-Y, British Columbia, V-5J-3H-7, Canada.